ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults, and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nanup 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rounding up his speech, Mr. Singh thanked Singaporeans for their support, saying that he and his WP colleagues will endeavour to do their best for Singapore.
It's a scene familiar in every democracy. The leader of a political party has been deposed. Though still sitting in Parliament, their time as opposition leader is no more.
Whatever Parliament decides, and as long as I'm a member of Parliament, I will continue my work as an MP on the ground in Aljunied GRC. And I will continue to advocate for Singaporeans in Parliament to the best of my abilities, as I have for the last 15 years.
It's a brutal reality of politics that opposition leaders come and go. Just part of the grind of the democratic process. But Singapore's Pritam Singh was no ordinary opposition leader. His tenure in that position came and recently went at the whim of the ruling People's Action Party, the PAP. That he was sacked not by his own side, but by the party he opposes, says much about the peculiar nature of what Singapore calls its democracy. It has all the trappings of a Westminster system, but critics say it's actually a one-party state. And on that score, it's hard to get past the fact that in its 61 years of existence, the Republic of Singapore has never had a change of government.
There are free and fair elections on Election Day. In general, people have a significant degree of civil liberties, although less than in a full democracy. And while it's free and fair on election day, there are a wide range of roadblocks set up to make it very challenging for anyone but the longtime ruling party, the People's Action Party, to win. It's verging now on a flawed democracy, but it's still really competitive authoritarianism.
Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Rear Vision. Now, Pritam Singh was accused by the government of lying under oath to a parliamentary committee, and that committee, which was dominated by the PAP, well, it then referred the matter to the Office of the Public Prosecutor. A subsequent trial found against Mr. Singh, and that's the official reason given for why the government removed his status as opposition leader. Mr. Singh, a trained lawyer, continues to deny he did anything wrong. The history of independent Singapore is the story of a trade-off between democratic freedoms and promised prosperity. But now, at the beginning of its seventh decade of independence, with prosperity and its global status secured, why does the powerful city-state find it so difficult to shake itself free from the grip of its authoritarian founder? To understand that, we first have to go back to the very beginning of the Republic and to the drive and focus of its first Prime Minister.
After a resounding victory at recent general elections, first to take the oath of office was the Prime Minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, swearing to bear true faith and allegiance to the state.
It's 1965, and Singapore has just become an independent country, following its separation from the Federation of Malaysia. Michael Barr, Associate Professor of International Relations at Flinders University.
Lee Kuan Yew is really the architect of the Singapore political system. I mean, he didn't start from scratch. He inherited a pseudo-Westminster system from the British, but he turned it into a rule by Prime Minister's office, and everything emanates from there. And he was the first Prime Minister. He was Prime Minister from 1959, before Singapore was a republic, when it was still a colony, actually, right up to 1990. And there's always been either him or another member of his family in cabinet for every moment since 1959, and still is today.
Now, he was urbane, he was articulate, but he was also ruthless, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a British-trained lawyer, a Cambridge-trained lawyer. David Lange, the former New Zealand Prime Minister, once caught him in a lift and asked him, why is it that with all his law training, he locks up his opponents? And he slapped him on the shoulder and he said, David, that's because it's become unfashionable to shoot them.
So he came to very quickly dominate Singapore politics. What was the social contract, if you like, that he promised to the Singaporese people? Why did they stay with him for so long?
Lee Kuan Yew started off as the first among equals. He started off with a very strong team of people with their own minds. He was the last man standing. The others had all retired or been pushed out or died. And he was still there, you know, for another decade and a half later. And he used that time to make his stamp and make sure that his family continued to be represented. His social compact was that in exchange for freedoms, for real democracy and real choice in elections, and in exchange for putting up with a whole bunch of impositions from the state, it's called the nanny state, he gave security, he gave economic growth, he built houses for population that was up at that to that time substantially living in shanty towns, and he turned Singapore from really a first-class colonial economy engaged with trade into a manufacturing centre as well as a trading centre. And he did deliver all that. And he delivered on the social contract much better than some of his successors have.
Why didn't he believe that all of that could be done with him as Prime Minister but with a fully functioning democracy in the country?
He was a bit paranoid. He was a control freak. He had these two contradictory impulses. He wanted to bring the people with him and he wanted to consult. He was very big in consulting and very clever at it. But he also had to keep complete control. And those two things, autocracy and collegiality, he always struggled to make those mix. And there was no question when he was around, he was the epitome of the clever autocrat. So yes, I have said that he could have done so much of this in a properly democratic system and retaining people's freedoms, and that was not something that he was terribly interested in. He couldn't see any upside to it in engaging in his project.
Remember this, good ministers are not just those who kiss babies and smile and have dialogue sessions. You can have endless dialogue sessions, it's very good, you keep on listening and so on. It means at the end taking very tough, very unpleasant, very unpopular decisions and still smiling and still explaining. And finally, pointing out, see, we are turning the corner. The figures prove it. That's what government is about.
In the 1965, that's the era of Lee Kuan Yew, and he was prime minister at that time, and he was a very dominant figure, and he sought to control Singapore's fate. And he made it very difficult for the opposition. He arrested numerous of them in late-night operations, and that's called the Operation Cold Store. And after that, the leading opposition party, the only opposition party at that time, the Barisan Socialis, in 1966, decided to resign from parliament, giving the PAP a total monopoly over power.
Assistant Professor Stephen Ortman from Hong Kong Metropolitan University.
So basically after that event, then the PAP completely controlled all of Singapore's politics. There wasn't any opposition.
Now, despite the trappings of a Westminster democracy, was Singapore always destined to be a one-party state?
Well, I would say if it is 1959 when the PAP gained power, it wasn't clear at that time because the British wanted to get a democracy going at the beginning. But it was actually, I would say it was Lee Kuan Yew and the people he worked together with, they managed to, fairly quickly consolidated power over the system by using all kinds of methods to get rid of the opposition, by using an Internal Security Act, by arresting opposition members, as I already mentioned, and then Singapore fairly quickly became the one-party state after that.
What was it about Lee Kuan Yew that he was so successful and also so driven in terms of moulding Singapore to the way he wanted it?
Yeah, well, he was English educated, who wasn't really part of the Chinese community, but he made himself into a supporter of the Chinese in Singapore. So he learned Chinese, he emphasized Chinese interests, and he decided that Singapore was going to be an independent country, strong nationalistic sentiment there. And he wanted to, I mean, I think it's his personality. He was very driven toward turning Singapore into something successful. And he used strategically, I mean, to his credit, he emphasized economic development and Singapore's strength and find all these aspects to make Singapore into a modern city state. And you have to know that in 1963, he actually wanted Singapore to be united with Malaysia to form a single state because he believed a city state wouldn't be able to survive and wouldn't be able to prosper in the future. But of course, his political ambitions were very strong. And so the Malaysian government was always suspicious of him. And so decided eventually that this wasn't really going to work because Singapore would be too powerful. The Chinese majority in Singapore would be too strong. And then Lee Kuan Yew could be too dominant in all of Malaysia. And so the two parted ways. It's still a debate over how Singapore actually split, whose decision it was in the end. But it's clear that Singapore became, after that, a very dominant state in the region, despite being so small.
Despite the heavy-handed tactics used against those who opposed the government, Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew, it has to be said, did have a significant personal following.
So Singaporeans, I mean, majority voted him into power, and he did have enormous popular support, I would say. And of course, it strengthened after the successes that he could show, yeah, through the economic development, which was very successful. And I mean, Singapore was already very strong state within the British Empire, but after that, it really flourished under his rule. And he learned from other countries, sent people there, tried to find the best solutions, be a pragmatic leader rather than ideological. And Singapore also had, because it aligned itself with the West, yeah, it was able to benefit greatly from this position in the global power place by being close to the Western countries. So they used military alliance. I think also helped business and trading because Singapore relies to a large extent on trade and then finance. Yeah, and so I think by being at the heart of this economic system, Singapore could flourish and get popular support from the people. The Singapore government strengthened that support by emphasizing social programs like public housing. Most Singaporeans now live in public housing, which is kind of a unique program because the Singapore public housing allows the people to buy into this housing and get leases. I mean, they buy a lease, then they own to some extent this house. It's like government-subsidized housing, I would say. It's not the government completely owns it, but by controlling all this public housing, I not only got the government support, it also gained power over the people because, yeah, nearly everyone was living in government-subsidized housing after that.
As we've heard, for the first 16 years of independent Singapore's existence, Lee's People's Action Party ruled supreme. But then something unexpected happened, something that the PAP had worked hard to ensure would never happen.
In 1981, they lost a by-election to a chap called Ben Jeyaretnam, and it was earth-shattering. And then 3 years later, in the next general election, another opposition candidate, Chiam See Tong, he was also elected. So you had two opposition members in parliament all of a sudden, and Lee Kuan Yew panicked. Opposition members of parliament. So he started introducing a whole series of changes to make it harder for the opposition because this just couldn't be allowed. They make a major change to the constitution on average once or twice a year. And some of them are so fundamental and some of them are just clearly designed to get one person. We saw that some years ago in 2019. They changed the rules for the eligibility for the presidency, very, very obviously, to cut out one person who probably would have won if he'd stood and he wasn't part of their ticket.
There was also, at one point, a decision by the ruling People's Action Party to change the rules around how people were elected. In 1988, the government introduced what they called the GRC system, GRC standing for Group Representation Constituency. It's a complicated arrangement, so I'll let Gillian Koh explain. Gillian is a senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore.
We have a system of group representation constituencies where in a parliamentary election, there are constituencies that are grouped together, maybe three, maybe four, maybe five. At some point, there was also six single member constituency wards grouped together. Why? Because there then is a requirement within these groups of constituencies that each party fielding candidates must have one minority non-Chinese candidate stand in that team. And this is to provide a minimum guarantee of representation of minorities in parliament. The criticism or the debate around that is whether it makes it difficult for the smaller opposition parties to contest if they had to come up with a team of three, four, five, or even six members, with one of them a minority. So it's what you call a hyper-majoritarian system. It seems to raise the barriers of entry for small parties, in that when you win group representation constituency, then it is winning five seats if it's a five-member GRC, and you win big. You win one and you win big.
Now, not all electorates in Singapore are decided by the group representation constituency system, but the majority are, and they've traditionally benefited the PAP, the People's Action Party. It's also worth noting that while Mr. Singh's Workers' Party fared well in recent elections, it still only holds just 12 seats in the parliament, while the PAP has 87, which is one of the reasons why the organisation Freedom House, which monitors political rights and civil liberties, well, why they say of Singapore,
the electoral and legal framework that the PAP has constructed allows for some political pluralism, but it constrains the growth of opposition parties and limits freedoms of expression, assembly and association.
And you're listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio national production. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today we're pondering the nature of Singapore's political system. Why, after six decades, has it struggled to progress from a one-party state to a fully functioning democracy?
I took this country from a very low base in the third world, and in 30 to 40 years, gradually transformed it into a first world country. And now it's gone on to a different leadership.
Now, in 1990, Lee Kuan Yew stood down as Prime Minister. His successor was Goh Chok Tong, a capable politician but widely seen as a stopgap leader. Goh's time in the top job ended when Lee's son, Lee Hsien Loong, was ready to take over, and Lee Jr. then held power until 2024, when he appointed his deputy, Lawrence Wong, as Singapore's fourth Prime Minister. Wong inherited, among other things, a compliant media and judicial system, according to Joshua Kurlansik, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Singapore Press Holdings owns many of the leading media outlets, is a state company. They're not as dominant as they used to be because there's a lot of online publications, and there are online publications that publish more critical or just more factual stories. The PAP can't really control those publications or social media in general, but they definitely still have huge influence over the media. The judiciary, I mean, I can't tell you for sure, but I would say from observation that in matters related to business or civil things, like, you know, someone sues someone because they didn't build their house correctly or whatever, the judiciary is of high quality. But when it comes to matters related to politics, and specifically ones directly involving the PAP, their decisions don't seem to be as well considered, and I wouldn't consider them to be impartial in the way they are on business matters. On business matters, most companies in Southeast Asia, even foreign companies, often use Singapore as a site for arbitration. But
and that ability to get business done in a reliable manner arguably underpins Singapore's reputation on the broader international stage. And it explains perhaps why many Western leaders who talk often of the values of democracy like to turn the other way when it comes to the city-state's particular form of government.
Government to government, military to military, I think the Australians are fully aware of the shortcomings of the Singapore system in terms of ideals and values. But government-to-government relations really aren't about that. So, you know, and military-to-military relations aren't about that either. So they get on with business. The Australians know that they are dealing with professionals. There's a high level of predictability in dealing with them. And when they have deals done and things signed, they actually mean something. And the Singaporeans also have an awful lot of money to invest. That's one of the things that Lee Kuan Yew left them with, all these systems for building up the national finances controlled by the government, not by individual people or companies. So, yes.
I, Lawrence Wong, having been appointed to the office of Prime Minister, do solemnly swear that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Republic of Singapore, and that I will preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the Republic of Singapore. So help me God.
Prime Minister Wong has only been in the top job for less than 2 years. But the government's recent decision to withdraw the Leader of the Opposition's formal status on the grounds that he misled a parliamentary committee, well, that might suggest that old political habits die hard. Despite the perceived demotion, Pritam Singh remains the leader of the Opposition Workers' Party, and he still has a voice in Parliament. But how effective can he be? Michael Barr again.
Pritam Singh, he is a man of very high integrity, but that's not the thing that makes him stand out. I mean, the real difference is that he's Indian. Now, in Singapore, an Indian leading the opposition, let alone the government, is radical stuff. So that is actually, by his presence, he has transformed the Parliament into a more multicultural event. And his party, because his party, the Workers' Party, not very many years earlier than that, was effectively a Chinese party. And the Workers' Party, it was, it still is to some extent, it's like the ruling People's Action Party, only nicer and gentler. So they try to be. Pritam Singh has not fought some of the fights that I would have thought an opposition would want to fight. On the other hand, it is so hard in Singapore to fight, any political fight against the government, and still be around to fight the next one. Because they're very, very good at destroying people, whether if it's their careers or whether it's their legal standing or whatever, or their finances.
And Gillian Koh at the National University of Singapore argues that her post-election surveys suggest that Singapore's voters are becoming less interested in issues of democratic freedom and more interested in bread-and-butter economic and social concerns.
We've seen a reassertion of the materialist concerns so that they become higher up in the list of things that, you know, shaped citizens' votes. What are these? The concerns about cost of living, the concerns around my job. My job was one key thing that mattered to me as I went to the vote. And finally, how my estate is being managed. These are items that have come to the fore compared to the earlier rounds of the survey. And maybe that's understandable because the 2020 general election was held on the back of the pandemic. And the shift in how important these were about 7 to 8%. And in fact, the downshift to the popular vote for the PAP was, you know, slightly under that. So I think the materialist concerns shaped the little shift in the support for the opposition in that election. And this time around, the PAP actually came back and had a higher popular poll, you know, in support of it. And I think that in this case of the 2025 general election, there's recognition that the PAP was dealing with the materialist concerns of Singaporeans. So there was more support for the PAP, but also equal support for the opposition.
So the people, according to your research, the people have been happy with the compact that the PAP has had with the people, but they like having an opposition. Is there an expectation that from the citizens that there could possibly one day be a government that isn't a PAP government, that the opposition may one day form the government?
Well, in the main, I would say no. I think what our polls are suggesting in terms of the numbers that support having elected opposition, but with checks and balances, there's not a prevailing sentiment across the board that this is what is good. And this is also held true through the election results, of course. What I'm reflecting is sentiment post-election, asking people what it is that they really cared about when they went to the ballot box.
Singapore is a tiny island state, which, to use an old cliché, punches above its weight. It's been one of Southeast Asia's true economic success stories. But the world of 2026 is very different to that of 1965, when Singapore gained independence. Different even to just a few years ago. Navigating a fast-changing world, says Joshua Kalancic, will test the government of Lawrence Wong. Yes, but it will also test the opposition's mettle as well.
The world is highly unstable, and we've seen a number of elections recently in which voters chose very well-established parties, even though those parties themselves had had significant problems in the past. The LDP in Japan, a conservative pro-military party in Thailand, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party in Bangladesh. Establishment parties have won several elections in a row, I think in part because the world seems so unstable, the voters are looking for stability. I think that actually helped the PAP win the last election by more than they had won in 2020. The Workers' Party needs, or the opposition in general, needs to somehow get to a place where people in Singapore trust that they can run the government and provide stability. That's always been the problem. It was obviously much more of a problem when there was like one opposition MP in the 1980s, but they need to get to that place. And once they get to that place, if they're actually viewed by more than a majority of the population as genuinely able to govern, you would have possibly real competitive elections, even with roadblocks. I don't think they've totally done that yet, although obviously the PAP takes every chance they can to suggest that only the PAP is capable of providing stability and the Workers' Party is not. It's a counterfactual because the Workers' Party has never held power. But the Singaporean population is becoming more politically aware, especially younger people, and there are really serious problems. Singapore has among the highest costs of living in the world. There is huge inequality. I mean, the PAP is now trying to address this. There's major housing shortages. That's why the PAP is building housing like crazy. If those problems continue or get worse, and you also lack in the PAP a leader with a high degree of charisma, it's possible that the opposition could gain more, but it's a circular logic. They need to gain significantly more seats. And in order to do that, they need to make Singaporeans feel that they can be voted for and actually, should they win, be capable of governing. So it's a circular problem. But were they to get to 25, 30 seats, then you're on the doorstep of convincing people you can govern. I don't know if they'll be able to get that next time, but that's the hurdle.
There used to be a real ethos of wanting to help the country, wanting to build the country. Lee Kuan Yew is not loved for his flaws. He is loved, and he is, his love for his ideals. And he really did want Singapore to develop in the way that he wanted. He really did want to see the best for his country. And I do believe that that's something that has been lost in the more recent generations of elites.
Modern Singapore, still living in the shadow of its autocratic founder, Lee Kuan Yew. We heard today from Michael Barr at Flinders University, Stephen Ortman from Hong Kong Metropolitan University, Joshua Kalancic from the Council on Foreign Relations, and Gillian Koh from the National University of Singapore. You've been listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, News Radio, Radio Australia, and the CBC in Canada. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.